You're listening to Coach Your Brains Out by Gold Medal Squared. We'd like to welcome our newest patron to the show, John Lampson Kessel. This patron also happens to be this week's guest, so double thank you. To learn more about supporting the show, visit patreon.com/coachyourbrainsout. Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
We're excited to have back with us the Director of Sport Development at USA Volleyball, John Kessel. John, thanks for joining us once again.
Happy to be here, especially with all the great things you guys are doing with this Gold Medal Squared podcast partnership. I love it.
Yeah, we do too. Excited to be a part of a great organization. And we actually learned that recently that you're soon going to be the former director of sport development, as you're going to be retiring here shortly. His congratulations are in order, and wondering what led to that decision to retire and what's next.
Well, you know, I'm getting old. I've been doing volleyball for 50 years, and unlike my buddy Russ Rose, I don't think I want to keep coaching or doing it the same way I have been. It's time for new blood, I think, at USA Volleyball. I'm also going to get rid of my board position, or no longer be a board member for World Paravolley, and I'm going to more focus on the FIVB projects around the world and the World Paravolley projects, and just having some downtime because of this legacy project my wife and I have started 2 years ago for veterans and first responders, this place called Bison Peak Lodge. At the end of this year, I'll go do that project full time. And, you know, it's a pretty special place here in Colorado, the place that I fly fished when I was 17 years old. And now 50 years later, I'm living the same place about maybe a half a mile away from where I was fly fishing.
Yeah, you showed me some of the pictures of Bison Peak Lodge, and it looks unbelievable. What are you envisioning for that to be?
The longest range, it would be just a healing place for veterans, first responders, and their families. To get there, you got to, generate revenue, unless somebody comes in with a multi-million dollar check and says, hey, we love what you're doing, go for it. That hasn't happened, so we'll be doing a kind of unique coaching clinics. We have Challenge America that's been on the property with music therapy retreats for the vets that have PTSD. Amy Grant and Vince Gill donate Rogue guitars to every vet, and they get paired up with therapists, music therapists, and songwriters both, and they spend 4 days writing songs and to get the stuff out of their head, and they have a concert at the end. things like that. We've got, we had the Women's Olympic water polo team with us for 10 days. And fittingly, 7 days was a silent retreat because we're basically surrounded by 500,000 acres of nobody. And, they're getting ready for Tokyo. And so just sharing the wilderness with family, friends, and people that want to heal.
Really cool. Well, to do a Coach Your Brains Out retreat, huh, John? Once you
let's do it.
I would bring your guests on that have had the most impact, and I know that my dream and intent would be that you'd come with your family. Whenever I go do these for the 50 years of doing these clinics around the world, I have to leave my kids most of the time. When I went with McGowan and his wife Susan, and my kids came along, that was a not normal 2 weeks in Italy doing clinics. It was different. I kind of want to bring that back. And, you guys come up and everybody shares best principles and best ideas. And then you have some fun with your kids, because we got a 3D archery range with a velociraptor on the property. We got fly fishing. We've got BB gun range. We've got Cody designed a 9-hole putt-putt pine cone golf course where you putt the pine cone down the hill. So I don't know. It's a place that a lot of people have been. You know, Doug Beal has a cabin already named after him. But it's also a place of learning. And I really like that Adam, you know, the head coach of the women's water polo team was there, because to have him there and the ice hockey guys and have volleyball people there, you know, not just a single sport gathering, and be there with family. Enough said. People can come visit if they want, but that's my dream after I get leave USA Volleyball.
Really cool.
We're going to be there soon.
Yeah, sounds like a cool endeavor. Well, we wanted to spend this episode and look back through your career as a coach and some of the lessons learned. To start with, can you take us back and maybe describe what a first practice plan might have looked like for John Kessel back in the early days?
Well, okay, I'll go really early to when I was 10, because my dad started playing doubles in 1948. I've got a black and white photo that I'm really proud of in my office of him, you know, playing doubles at Emerald Bay, which we used to have a place. And that sort of means that I watched older players and better players play. My practice plan was watch and learn, get on the court after my name rose to the name on the list, lose 11-1, 11-0, and learn that winners stay on. And that principle was drilled into me young, and it's really what happens all the way up at the Olympic level. There's one gold medalist, and everybody else, you know, doesn't stay on, just that one winner stays on. So competition was inherent, even though we didn't have coaching in doubles. I don't, you know, think we really saw coaching until the 96 Olympics, but for those decades and decades of doubles, it, you know, you learn by playing the game and challenging yourself and watching better players, including just like Misty did and just like Karch did, losing a lot to adults on the scoreboard who were teaching you a hell of a lot about how to play at a much higher level than what you see when 13-year-olds play 13-year-olds and 14-year-olds play 14-year-olds. You know, the learning is not as effective at that level, but they get to go home with a big tall trophy because they won the 14 and under hootenanny or whatever, you know. I didn't get it experience that for a long time, taking home a first place trophy.
Yeah.
And then what about as a coach, what did those practices look like?
Well, so the practice plan had an inherently a lot of over the net play, to take advantage of the net. I think that's one of the two biggest mistakes I think coaches in America and around the world make still, is they play too much 6-on-6. And that's because you learn by doing, not by watching. And when you play doubles or triples or even fours, you're getting, you know, significant percentage more of reading and ball contact, learning by doing, not by watching somebody do it. And that is one of the things. The other thing is, to this day, people will take a half hour to put up a net, whether they're up at the beach or not. You know, you finally get the net up at the beach, you get the net up in the gym, and then the players will come in and they'll ignore the net for, gosh, 45 minutes, you know, unless they might serve a little. And they play on this one side of the net, even though every first ball and every third ball has to go over the net. Somehow we've got this huge disconnect of ignoring the net and the incredibly important read that takes place there. So practice plans for me are kind of like Marv used to play a lot of people one-on-one short court. And I think it was Reed and Riley Sammons played for, I don't know how many years, one-on-one short court. That over the net, even young or even early in your practice, with competition even, you know, some sort of scoring, that's what I like to do from the beginning. Now, it may not be competing, you guys, traditionally in the sense of I'm beating you. Instead, there's a lot of cooperation type scoring going on at the beginning of warm-up and the beginning of a practice, or throughout a third of the practice maybe, where you're actually challenged to keep the ball alive or challenged to do shots and still read it and keep it going and swing faster and faster and faster. But you're working to see how many you can do in net crossings in a row, which is real ball control. The tradition is most people come in and show you their ball control by partner passing and peppering. And I think we've, you know, I've said it so many times, it sort of makes me frustrated at times, but that's my fault for not being a very good teacher, clearly, that I can be the world's best pepper player or the world's best partner passer. I can do 1,000 in a row and 2,000 against the wall without an error. How good am I at serve receiving? How good am I at digging the ball to my partner in defense based on what those traditional things of partner passing and pair pepper are? So you don't see that in any of my practice plans, even way back at the beginning. I remember I was looking at a book recently, and I was doing a thing that I called alternating pepper. I didn't have a net, but in not having a net, what I did instead was spaced out, and I hit longer distance to you, and you dug it halfway. I ran forward, set you. Then after I set you, I backed up, and then after I set to you, I'm backing up, and you hit long distance to me, and then you run forward and dig the ball. So I'm always digging half the distance, not back to the spiker.
And where did those adjustments and those philosophies come from? I mean, it sounds like you were always pretty game-like. Did you have the motor learning knowledge back then, or what was just more fun to compete? Like, what kind of led you to make those decisions?
There's two parts. One, like probably many Southern California kids of my generation, we played doubles. We played over the net. We didn't think of doing things like, you know, hey, we've got the court, let's partner pass in front of it. No, let's play. That I know colored me as I came to college here and started coaching. I started coaching in 1970-71 here at Colorado College. And I was a player coach is what I was. You know, we had a men's division, a men's league going on before the Title IX changed a lot of our and cut back a lot of our men's collegiate programs that used to be around back in the early 70s and late 60s. So this ability to take advantage of the net. Then I met a guy named Carl McGowan, who has colored you both and many other people on this planet in wonderful ways. And it was then that I discovered, you know, the concept of motor skill learning. And, you know, that obviously way back in the beginning of my coaching, but also in the mid-70s started to change how I thought about sport and everything that I was doing. I almost went to BYU to play for the club team under Carl. And instead stayed and kept doing. I was working for a mountaineering firm called Holubar that let me play and practice like with the IBA and do things, but I still had a real job, so I, you know, could make money.
Yeah.
So I know you work with coaches a lot, and I'm wondering, does just sharing the, you know, the motor learning research, does that usually get them to make the change, or what do you find is the most effective way to get coaches to maybe change from peppering for 30 minutes in a warm up to, you know, getting into motor learning principles faster?
You know, I think in two words, it would be guided discovery. You know, Carl and I, we talked for decades. You know, you could ski with him, you could fly fish with him. There's a lot of things you could do and still do volleyball. In the case of this aha moment of Gentile and all these other people that were impacting him, in motor learning back in the 70s when he was a professor, he was more black and white. You know, you had Tom Black and Trinzi on talking, you know, and that classic story of Joe Trinzi saying, "I don't believe you," and Carl just saying, "Well, do your own damn chart." You know, that story always resonates with me because he was pretty, you know, direct, as Chris, his son, would tell you. And his players. And that was one of his strengths for sure. but it also scared and turned off some of the younger and probably less confident coaches, you might say, especially at the junior high level, that people that would come to attempt to learn and stuff. So we always had these conversations of how to guide discovery instead of just telling them, you got to do this. I've spent 20 years doing this. Believe me. I think what I work really hard to this day is to get people to discover it on their own, because when I tell you what to do, you learn it the weakest. When you figure it out yourself, you learn it the strongest, like a bike riding situation, you know? I mean, you ride a bike, it can be years and you don't ride it, but you can get on a bike and ride it because you learn it so well when you figure things out on your own. Well, somewhere in the middle, that's where you and I, and I think I, when I go back and listen to some of your older, earlier podcasts, I see that questioning and the way you both, as well as Niels and everybody, have learned to question more or guide or think, you know, and not just be black and white. I was pretty black and white in 1971, you know, it's sort of my way or the highway, and I didn't know that much.
Yeah, what were some of the things that maybe from back then you were reluctant to change that you have changed since or you bought in on?
That's one of the questions that I was wrestling when you asked that earlier. And I'd have to say that the biggest thing I've come to change is to be less of a coach and more of a mentor and less of a external telling you what to do, because I've been doing this for a few years, and more of a guide to guide your own discovery. Like I said earlier, that's the biggest change. It takes longer. I mean, it's a hell of a lot faster to just say, do this because I said so, but it's just not very effectively learned. And I also know that I think the other change is to let the players become my assistant coaches, all 12 of them, if I have a, you know, roster of 12, because I can only, if you two are on my team of 12, I can only give each of you in a 2-hour practice an average of 10 minutes of feedback and attention per player. It's not the 10 minutes that I'm paying attention to you that really matters. It's, what are you doing during those other 110 minutes when I'm not looking at you? That's when you really get good. I've got a t-shirt that says on the back, are you learning? Because when I'm looking at somebody else and they're looking at my back, I want them to, are you learning now, even though I'm not looking at you, you know, and paying attention to you or whatever. And so by getting kids to coach younger kids, and I did that from the start as a player coach at Colorado College, to get that to happen, I discovered and changed to be more comfortable with the players coaching themselves or coaching their teammates and being these essentially my assistant coaches. So what happened there? I went from the source of all knowledge to this day, doing my best to give everybody whatever I think is really effective. Because it's, again, it's not black and white. I was do it this way when I was younger. And now I'm kind of guiding and saying, okay, I've got identical twins on these two teams. I'm going to do this and you're going to do what you've been doing over here. You tell me who's going to learn faster in the same amount of time if we do this and you do that. And they look and they go, the way you're doing it. And then you ask that incredibly important question. Why? And then they start to ponder and think, and you go, well, I think that's a great, I think you're probably spot on. Go show me, you know, type stuff. So that, I think that's the big change. I was sort of, everybody revolved around me because I was the head coach too. No, I'm helping everybody become my assistant coaches, called the players.
Yeah. So I think that's a really important point. And I see the value of having not just one coach, but all of a sudden 12. So what are some of the ways that you train your players to become assistant coaches?
You know, I think the story that resonates the most with me is Trevor Reagan. His mom asked me and my kids to come up and do a camp for them maybe 2010, probably a decade or so ago. And this basketball kid coach named Trevor Reagan said, after I gave the kids in the camp, before the camp even started, a 90-minute dialogue and question and answer about how do we learn faster, and did these examples where you go, you're doing this, your two other friends are doing it this way, or three other friends are doing it this way. Who do you think is going to learn better in this summer camp? Who's going to learn better? And let me tell you some science, random versus blocked, and whole versus part, and you know, all these things that have been out there forever, it seems like now. And Trevor goes, does this stuff work for basketball? You know? And I said, Trev, this stuff is how you learn a skill like driving, bike riding, or basketball or volleyball, a motor program. This is what we seem to know from the research and the science. And so he kept asking those questions and ultimately evolved into someone who can teach it pretty well with his Train Ugly website, which came from, you know, how can I learn to get better faster? Go to watch Karch in the gym right now. Just go there and sit on the sidelines for a week and you'll learn a lot. And of course he did, and came back and said, is Train Ugly copyrighted? I said, no. You know, I heard it so many times out of Karch. I said, no, but you should ask Karch if it's okay to, you know, to name what you want to do Train Ugly. So I hope that explains it. I teach all my kids and even my parents, because if I don't, my parents go, he's not teaching the way I was taught. And that really means you get this kind of pushback from parents saying, no, they're not practicing well enough. And if the term that I learned the best at a USOC conference for high performance coaches, out of Dr. Richard Schmidt, the late Schmidt, Dr. Schmidt that did so many, like 5 textbooks on motor learning. He was listening to a bobsled coach and another coach, and they kept saying, you know, what if I did this? And he finally said, you guys, you're all in here practicing for practice, not to perform. And you're the Olympic team. You got to practice to perform, and it's not going to look pretty. You got to stop practicing so practice looks good if your sport is not pretty, you know. And of course, there's in that facility, we've got USA archery and we've got USA shooting. But even they, in learning from Dr. Schmidt on how do you learn more effectively, started to randomize their practice and shoot from different distances and shoot different spots on the target and not spend their entire life aiming at the bullseye. They randomize their own practices, even though they're pretty blocked as a skill. You know, you're supposed to hit that bullseye 10 out of 10 or 100 out of 100 or whatever, you know?
So what would you say, you know, looking back at, I know you're still coaching and still teaching, but looking back at your own coaching career, what would you say some of your biggest strengths are?
A passion to make other people become better teachers, regardless of where they're from. You know, with all due respect to Make America Great, you know, one of the gold medal squared lines, of course, is a rising tide lifts all boats. Straight out of Carl's mouth, probably 25 years ago. And I love going around the world, sharing ideas and getting new ideas from these other thinkers who have not, you know, been in the petri dish of USA competitive sports, you know, like like Tom Black was talking about how, you know, we're pretty competitive. You're competitive, Billy. You guys, John, you guys are competitive. And so was Tom. And then he goes up to Canada and discovers a different culture, you might say. Mm-hmm. But last time I checked, one of the facts in our sport is that every ball that's served in a junior high match in front of the parents with a referee, and the same thing at the Olympics, a point is scored every single time. And if you don't put that in some way into your practice, as much as you're saying, I'm training game-like, you're not, because you're forgetting the score, which is part of reality. And so you're not doing what I Love Marv said decades ago. You know, you're not training in reality. You're training back to that mistake I made as a young coach, practicing so practice looked good. And then, of course, you get blown out of the water, right? You know, I don't get it. We can pass 300 in a row back and forth across the net in our little shuttle system of passing straight back to where it came from, but we're not serve receiving, you know, at all. Yet we pass so well. Yeah, because you're not training in reality. Reality is that the ball gets served from the end line and comes screaming over the net. Even if you're 13, you can do a serve that can ace an Olympian. And you have to deflect it off your arms, and you can't buy any equipment to make it easier, and send it over to your teammate who's going to set the ball up, hopefully. And that is not partner passing ever. In fact, I don't know if I think, Billy, are you a setter?
Yeah, of course I am.
Okay. You're all setters, but.
Yeah, but in college, yeah, I set.
Yeah. So you please stand there to the right of center and you wave your hand and you know, you're a freshman and you go over here, guys, or you're a senior, and you go over here, and they rip a floater or a jumper down the line to zone 4 and 5 on the left side of the court. Where likely is that ball going? To you, behind you, or in front of you?
I'd say in front of me.
In front of me. Me too, I said. And so we start moving forward. Even though we're waving over here and saying right here, even though you may have put a bucket there for I don't know how many serving drills to catch balls like I used to. That was one of my older mistakes, if that's even the right term. I just had too many gimmicky things and not enough players doing the positions and letting everybody set and letting everybody become all around players. I was specializing way too early, I think. And so, you know, I mean, that's the reality that is our sport, and we just don't train enough in reality. We train so things look pretty.
Yeah. I should say, unless John was passing, and then I would expect it to be right to me.
That's right.
But no, John.
So nice to each other.
Yeah. John, that's an awesome strength. I know we've benefited from it, your passion for coaching coaches. If you had to say, what would be a weakness that you might have had? And if you can think of one, are you still working on improving it?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of ask it a little bit later too about, you know, coaching coaches, the most effective way to do it. I'm still learning, because I'll do what I'm thinking is a pretty good clinic. And if I come back and watch them a week later, it's like, did you go to the clinic? Mm-hmm. I haven't seen any change. So my biggest weakness is still, as a teacher, as Wooden says, you haven't taught them if they haven't learned. And I'm saying learning is happening because they change or they do it more effectively. And I want to say that again, Carl and I, you know, talking about this stuff, his black and whiteness, I've found that I get more change if I say less or more effective, less or more efficient in this guided discovery type process. I see more coaches changing if I'm not black and white. I, you know, my blog has been on the USA website for 12 years or something, maybe 13. And you know, in all those writings, the beginning, I would do things like stop teaching passing or stop doing this. And you get this blowback from all these people that would go, well, I did it and I'm still a good player, you know. And I realized that I was losing people that might be willing to learn and change because I was using a black and white thing, stop. And so now I either say limit, or I'll say in the article, which is more effective? And that's all I'm asking about.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that as a coach hearing that, not being as defensive and actually being open to hearing you out.
Exactly. And I mean, our job, your podcast, is all about getting coaches to change so that they are more effective in sharing the amazing uniquenesses of our sport, whether it's doubles, sitting, volleyball, para beach, or the, you know, our Olympic team or our elementary school volleyball. Amazing. And our 80 and over national championships. You know, we truly are a sport of a lifetime. In that, I hate seeing kids leave our sport because of the coach. And I see that a lot. So I want, even if you're going to do things not as effectively, if I can first get you to be better at keeping kids loving the sport that they've discovered and not being driven away because of your teaching methods, then that's the most highest priority. It's like when they threw me in the ABC Hall of Fame and I said, my record is 10,300 and whatever, and 35 losses. And everybody goes, yeah. Because I have no idea how many matches I've won and lost, but I know the 35 kids that I coached who quit volleyball the next year. And the last one, her name was Crystal. And that's how I would judge a listener here to Coach Your Brains Out. Isn't on your record, because you're going to only have, I mean, every match ever played in the history of our sport has 50% of the people lose, the teams lose. I mean, that's outcome based aside, that's fact. You're going to lose half the time in the broad factual picture. So if you base everything on winning and losing, you're going to be miserable sometimes. And if you judge it by how many kids stay and play the next year or stay in sport, even, I'm okay with them leaving volleyball, but not giving up on the amazing lifetime benefits of good sport. Then I think you're a great coach, even if your record's 0-30, you know, or 0-200 or whatever. And every kid comes back to play the next year. And you know that that's not going to happen if they keep coming back, because they're getting better. They're not leaving.
Yeah, those are definitely big wins. I know you've been around a lot of really good coaches. I'm wondering if you've seen any common strengths or common qualities in the best coaches you've spent time around.
I think I'm going to paraphrase it. They know best that players don't care how much you know about volleyball until they know how much you care about them. Mm. That relationship is where you see the strongest coaches. I mean, why are you going to spend years of your life learning to bounce a ball off body parts? I mean, where you can't go to you can't go to Big Five or Dick's Sporting Goods and buy, oh, Billy, you know, I'm going to get you the extra long blocking arms, you know, so that you can get, you know, get over even better. I'm going to get the Phil Dahlhauser model, you know, when you go out and play the next time. But we don't get to buy that stuff that softball gets to and hockey gets to and lacrosse gets to. And, you know, we don't get to buy that stuff. We have to, and golf, oh my God, golf, they spend billions on the technology. We have our body, you know, I mean, that's it. It's a popular nudist sport. They don't need any tools. They just play volleyball. And in that spirit, you know, you got to then, back to your question, John, a little bit, you want to coach the kid who's in front of you. I think that's what the great ones do. They care about their athletes, and they know their athletes well enough that when they coach not some other, or I want you to be like this player. I'm coaching this player. So they coach the player in front of them. I think those are the two things that I see them do the best.
That was part one with John Kessel. Join us next week for part two as we discuss more lessons learned throughout his coaching career.